We're reading in John's Gospel, and in the Bible in the pew in front of you, it's on page 1078, it's John chapter 11, and we're picking up on the story we read last Sunday night, the great story of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, and we're going to look at some of the repercussions and reactions to that event tonight. I'm going to read the first part of our reading just now, beginning at verse 45. Of John 11. Therefore, many of the Jews who'd come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did put their faith in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing? They asked. Here is this man performing many miraculous signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. And one of them, named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. He did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation. And not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. Therefore, Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the Jews. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the desert, to a village called Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, many went up from the country to Jerusalem for their ceremonial cleansing before the Passover. They kept looking for Jesus, and as they stood in the temple area, they asked one another, "What do you think? Isn't he coming to the feast at all?" But the chief priests and Pharisees had given orders that if anyone found out where Jesus was, he should report it so that they might arrest him. If you just keep your Bibles open there. Well, we're in the evening shadows, as it were, of that extraordinary, glorious scene that we looked at last week, when the power and authority and majesty of Jesus burst forth on a little unsuspecting village, a little grieving family, and I trust something of it burst forth from the pages of Scripture last week in our hearts too. And in the shadows of that story, I think I detect three distinct features. There's probably a lot more, but you know me, once I find three I give up. And so there are three distinct things I want us to see tonight in these verses that were read to us. The first of them, very striking in the shadow of this great act of Jesus, is a serious division. Jesus calls out, "Lazarus, come out," and he comes. And John records that some of Mary's friends, who saw what Jesus did, put their faith in Jesus. There's one reaction, verse 45. But in the very next reaction, we discover that some who saw it went straight to the Pharisees, and by verse 53, they are plotting with them to take his life. I think we saw last week that this sign of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead was really the greatest of the signs, the most majestic of them, the most glorious of the seven that John has told us about in his Gospel. So here, in a sense, is Jesus at his greatest, his clearest. And there is, in the shadow of it, a polarizing of responses. On the one hand, it leads for some to come out from the crowd, from that group of onlookers, observers, and they nailed their colours to the mast, as it were, to say yes with Martha, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, to put their faith in him as the one who alone can raise the dead. And on the other hand, polarized at the other extreme, it appears that some people were hardened in their hearts in response to what they saw. And that kind of hardening of the heart comes together in a meeting of the Sanhedrin, as John records for us. Now, what was the Sanhedrin? It was a kind of a quasi-religious group, a kind of political religious group. It was a Jewish group who were granted political legitimacy by the recognition of by the Roman occupying force. And so in many senses they're part of the status quo. They have authority. Nothing can really happen amongst the Jewish community without the permission of the Sanhedrin. They have great authority. But they are there by permission and by authorization of the Romans, and so they're really part of the establishment, part of the status quo. Now, why are they so afraid? What is it that they fear about Jesus that they react so strongly and so badly to this great and good thing that he has done? Well, it seems if you read their dialogue here, that they're afraid of a kind of popular uprising around Jesus that will lead to a destabilizing of society, and therefore the Romans will respond and clamp down and impose stronger direct rule. And what will that mean for them? Well, it will mean a loss of their place, their power, their status, their prestige. And that's a very powerful and addictive cocktail. When your place, your position, your prestige is under threat, that's a very powerful motivation. And we need to take this seriously, this division. It's not that it just happens to happen in the wake of Lazarus. It's something that the Bible tells us happens whenever Jesus is exalted, whenever Jesus is seen in his glory, whenever Jesus is proclaimed and shown forth. This is what happens. Simeon, who took the little Jesus, greeted the little Jesus and the baby Jesus in the temple in his formative days, and his prophecy said this: this child, Jesus, is destined to cause the falling and rising of many in Israel, and to be a sign that will be spoken against, so that the thoughts of many hearts will be revealed. And Jesus himself says in Luke chapter 12, do you think I came to bring peace on earth? No, I tell you, division. It's wishful thinking if you think getting Jesus out there will get everybody loving him. If you think that people will just see him, everyone will adore him, and we'll all be one peace on earth. Wishful thinking. Because actually something else happens. The thoughts of many hearts will be revealed to Simeon. What happens when the light shines in the darkness? Well, reality is exposed. Reality is exposed. What happens in the morning? What will happen tomorrow morning? About whatever time sunrise is tomorrow. When's the sun rising just now? Come on, you early risers. We see it every day. Ed, you sent me a text about 6:15 Monday morning recently, so I don't know what time. But tomorrow morning when the sun rises, something of the reality of our life will be exposed. Because some of you will jump up out of bed and say, it's a morning, I can't wait to get on. You'll be revealed as morning people. And some of us will go, oh no, not another day. Where's the pillow? And in a more serious way, of course, when the lights go on in here, you know, the work of the cleaners is exposed. Did they do it this week? How long did they work for? The dust is showing up. Or the cleanliness is showing up. And when the light of Jesus comes into the world, the light shines in the darkness. And the reality of men's hearts winning heart is exposed. And that's what's happening here. Here as the light shines, the faith of some comes to the surface. They see and they believe. But the coldness and the self-centeredness and the self-protectiveness of others is exposed and it comes to the surface. And Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians that that's what happens in all gospel work. You'll remember his phrase that he puts it. It's a nice little place to go because it is similar motif to the story we're about to look at. 2 Corinthians 2:15. For we are to God the aroma of Christ among those who are being saved and those who are perishing. To one we are the smell of death, to the other the fragrance of life. The same gospel going out, and there are two different effects and two different people. And the one, it's the savour of life, to another it confirms them in their sinfulness. And you and I need to see this serious division and take it seriously that this is what happens in gospel life. Well, a serious division is the first thing we see, and secondly, we see a surprising sentence. There are not too many minutes of the Kirk session or congregational board meetings left over from the days of Jesus, but there is here a minute of a meeting of the Sanhedrin, and the dialogue is recorded for us word for word, and particularly the words on the lips of the high priest Caiaphas. You know nothing at all. Well, many a moderator has been tempted to say that at a church session meeting, but there you go. He said it. You know nothing at all. And it's not a very impressive sentence. You know nothing at all. Actually, I think if you read before it, they've been debating. And here's a man whose mind is closed. You're a bunch of ignorance. He's not even willing to consider possibility. You know nothing at all. My mind is closed to you. And then this extraordinary sentence, surprising. You do not realize that it's better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. Well, who was Caiaphas that spoke these words? Well, he's the son-in-law of Annas, a powerful priest whose family, it seems, occupied the high priest's chair, the high priest's role, for about 50 years. Four sons and one son-in-law, Caiaphas, occupied it for this length of time. And Caiaphas himself served for about 18 years, including right over the period when Jesus was crucified. And on the surface, his words here represent cynicism that the 21st century would be proud of. Better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. It's a sentence that makes it out as though his real concern is the Jewish nation. Better that we offer up one sacrificial lamb than that the Romans crush us all. But of course, underneath, it's really a sentence only concerned with the status quo, his place and his position. But there is another angle in these words, isn't there? And the interesting thing is that John kind of breaks the habit of a gospel here. For normally, he drops little depth charges into his storytelling, into his gospel narrating, and he waits to see them exploding in our minds as we suddenly get what he's saying. But here, these words on Caiaphas' lips seem to be so surprising because they speak remarkable truth that John can't wait for us to see what he's saying and for it to dawn on us. So he points it out to us himself. He didn't say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. Here is an unwitting prophet. He spoke some words the truth of which he himself did not realize, did not appreciate. And in his sentence, recorded in Holy Scripture, is this truth that Jesus' death would be for the benefit of others. That's why tonight we remember that day. That's why in the Christian church, ever since it happened, regularly, consistently, people have gathered above all things to remember about Jesus, his death, because it was for the benefit of others. Not as Caiaphas perhaps foresaw in his own mind, but certainly as God intended for the benefit of others. What are we to make of this surprising sentence on Caiaphas' lips? Well, I think there's a warning here about a very foolish way to make decisions, the way of expediency. What's good for me now? That's essentially how Caiaphas and his cohorts decide what to do with Jesus. They're not interested in what the truth of Jesus might be or what the good of Jesus might be. They're interested in what is good for me now, today. What will secure my position? And they become unwitting accomplices in the crucifixion of the Son of God. There's a warning for us about the danger of making decisions on the basis of what is expedient. But secondly, there's a warning here, it seems to me, about the possibility of holding divinely appointed office and speaking divinely appointed truth and knowing nothing of the divine appointment. Is that not an awful possibility? That here is a man who occupies the high priest's position, a divinely appointed role, and he speaks words that are remarkable in their truth, and yet standing before him is the one, the great high priest, and he doesn't know him. Thirdly, the sovereignty of God. Evil rears its ugly head here and spits its poisonous venom in a meeting of the Sanhedrin. But God remains sovereign. These little puppets, who think themselves to be so important and to whom their place is so significant, scorning the Son of God. But God will have his way, even if it is overruling the speech of those who intend otherwise. Proverbs puts it like this: the king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes. The psalmist says, kings and rulers of this world counsel against the Lord, but he who sits in the heavens laughs. Many are the plans in a man's heart, but the counsel of the Lord will stand. You know nothing at all. Boy, we're tempted to say that sometimes, aren't we? And usually it's only the sign of ignorance and arrogance. Here's a closed mind. He doesn't understand what is going on. He thinks he holds the strings of power and has in his hands the destiny of Jesus Christ. But God in heaven laughs. For he is sovereign, he will have his way. A surprising sentence. And then thirdly and lastly, chapter 12, a superb act. And it is with relief, is it not, that we turn from the plots of the conspirators, to the perfume of Mary. She's the sister of Martha and Lazarus. And we've met her just in the previous chapter, grief-stricken, tear-stained. And now we find her in this beautiful account that John gives us. And it is a thing of great beauty. A pint of pure nard, he tells us, an expensive perfume, and later Judas kindly informs us it was worth a year's wages. Well, I don't know if any of you have a bottle of perfume that cost you a year's wage. I doubt it. That would be reckless in the extreme to spend a year's wages on perfume. So any of you guys that are trying to impress girls, don't think there's an example here that you ought to follow and spend a year's wages on one bottle of perfume. But you spent it all in a moment. I can't imagine that Mary or Martha or Lazarus had anything in their house of greater value. Do you have anything in your house that costs you apart from your house more than what you earn in a year? I doubt it. It was the very best thing that she had. And without a moment's hesitation, and without a moment's reserve, she spent it all on Jesus. And how much it meant to him, how significant it was to him. You can't read his words here or the accounts of what is probably the same story in Matthew without sensing in Jesus' words what a great strength, comfort, encouragement it was to him in these dark and difficult days. How often it is it not, that what we give is the leftovers when the holidays are paid for and the mortgage is paid and the car is financed, and what is left we give to him? But she gave the first place, the best thing she had, and how much it meant to him. What a beautiful act. Let me try and help you to see the heart from which this act arose, because I think Mary's heart contrasts with the heart of those around them, and that's why her actions contrast with those around her. First of all, can you see the contrast between the humility of Mary and the pride of the Sanhedrin? They're all concerned with their place and their position. That's very important to them. And Mary comes and anoints Jesus' feet. Matthew and Mark tell us that she anointed his head. And that's probably the truth, it's probably the case. And their reasoning is that she was anointing him as her king. But the quantity of perfume means it wouldn't all have been used up there. It would have covered his whole being. And so John's focus is on his feet. Sorry, I'm getting my head and her mixed up here terribly. And he wants us to see that she goes to his feet. He's about to tell us of Jesus' action in washing the disciples' feet, of embodying in himself the role of a slave on their behalf. And surely Mary is placing herself in the place of a slave at Jesus' feet here, the place, the no place. While the Sanhedrin are concerned that their place might be taken from them, she goes to the no place and offers herself to Jesus. She breaks open her perfume and she spends it on him from a humble heart. What have we sung tonight? I'm humbled by your mercy. And I'm broken inside. Lord, receive the sacrifice of a broken heart. Well, are these words on your lips the truth in your heart? Is your heart concerned with your place? Or is it broken? And happy to occupy the place of no place that Jesus speaks. Secondly, can you contrast the ignorance of the crowds with the attentiveness of Mary's spirit? The crowds are coming up for the Passover and they're full of questions about Jesus. What do you think? Isn't he coming to the feast at all? Where is he? What's he about? Is this his great day? And they don't really know, and they don't know where he is, and they don't know what's going on. But Mary seems to know something. Jesus says, leave her alone. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. It's almost as if he's saying, this is the moment this perfume was made for. And she knows that. She sees that. And this is the reason I'm in this house tonight. To receive this person. He seems to know what's going on. And one has to conclude that she knows what's going on because of the attentiveness of her spirit. You see, we've already read in another gospel earlier that taking her place at Jesus' feet was not a one-off for Mary, but the posture of her life. Remember, when he visited the home, she sat at his feet and listened. And those who sit at his feet and listen understand him and know him. And here is an act that arises from a heart that's attentive to Jesus. Thirdly, I wonder if you can contrast the seeming wastefulness of Mary with the apparent watchfulness of Judas. I say seeming. I feel like the extravagance of Mary and the meanness of Judas, isn't it? And if we read the other gospel writers, we find that Judas is not alone, that the other disciples shuffle uneasy at this act of worship and this display of love. And if I'm honest, I do too. I'm unsettled down. I'm uneasy. I don't really understand how unseemly of this scene. John tells us that she wiped his feet with her hair. She let her hair down. And in that culture, that was so inappropriate. Maybe in the quietness of your own home and no one is there. But on a public occasion, by the way, how unseemly. Are you not a little embarrassed by this, if you're honest? A little uneasy with it? And that's because there stays in me at times, and I fear in many of us, little corners of our heart that, like Judas, are not wholly converted. Little places that are unguarded and unchecked and unmortified and undealt with. And Judas' story is a warning to us. It's very easy to read back into this episode and say, well, that's the way he was, but we're much better to read forward and see that actually the seeds are here that are allowed to sprout into what happened days later. There is a story told there of a man in a shipwreck, and as the ship went down, he was on the ship because he was transporting a load of gold, and he wanted to save his gold, and so he tied it to his waist. And needless to say, when the ship was found at the bottom of the ocean, a body was found with the gold still attached. And John Ruskin, the Victorian philosopher who used to tell this story to his classes, said as the man was sinking, did he have the gold or did the gold have him? And I suppose the question is, was Judas the keeper of the money or was money the keeper of Judas? And that makes me wonder about those little corners of my heart that remain ill at ease with this end. Charles Wesley wrote these words, O love divine, how sweet thou art. When shall I find my willing heart all taken up by thee? I thirst, I faint, I die to prove the greatness of redeeming love, the love of Christ for me. Oh, that Mary's restlessness would be echoed in our hearts. But then the significance of her worship. Her beautiful self-forgetful act points forward to Jesus' wonderful self-giving act. For exactly 1 week from that Saturday evening, Jesus' body, anointed for a second time, would lie in a cold and silent garden tomb. And Mary, in an act motivated by gratitude, has pointed forward to the death of Jesus. And ultimately, what Mary did in her act of worship is all that you and I can do in worship. Forget about ourselves and focus on heaven. And in lives of gratitude, point not forward, but point back to his great act of self-giving. That's the heart of worship. Where the whole realm of nature and mind was singing in it, that were an offering far too small. Love so amazing, so divine. Demands my soul, my life, my love. You think a year's wages, how much? But you think of what an act of worship is about. Responding to the giving of Jesus, and you think how little a year's wages are. And that's why it's true to say that ultimately opening a checkbook and putting a signature on it is the easy way to worship. But opening a heart and signing it away and its rights is a much more demanding act of worship. But what else can you do? It was a meal given in Jesus' honour that Mary responded to Jesus' great gift of life to her brother. And great promise of life to all who believe. And this is a meal given in Jesus' honour. We come to signs and symbols of Jesus' gift of life to us by his own death and promise of life for us. This we are to learn from Mary's superb act. It must surely be in this way. Learn that everything we do, we have and are, must be sanctified and controlled by and offered up in the light of the cross. The story is told of Count von Zinzendorf, a wealthy nobleman in Germany. Some of whose hymns we still sing today, most notably Jesus, Thy Blood and Righteousness, once standing before a painting of Christ crucified, and underneath it was inscribed these words, I have done all for thee, what hast thou done for me? and the love of Christ broke through into this wealthy nobleman's heart. And he engaged himself with a group known as the Moravian Mission. And out of that came what we would call today a 24/7 prayer movement. For the next 100 years, the fruit of which was the modern worldwide missionary movement, all of which stems from one man looking at the cross of Christ and saying and hearing, "I have done all for thee, what hast thou done for me?" And who knows what the fruit of life broken and offered in response to his offering would be in our day and generation. Mary's offering, the fragrance of it filled the whole house. There's a sense in which Zinzendorf, the fragrance of it, covered the whole house. Who knows what the fruit of life offered up would be if we take these